the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. National Geographic Magazine held a major press conference today to roll out its newest discovery. It's not a new planet. It's not a new moon. It's not a new people group. It's an ancient document. It is called the Gospel of Judas, and you're going to be seeing it all over the media. And already, if you just look at the cable news and at the news on the Internet, it's being presented as a corrective to the New Testament, an ancient text that tells us something we didn't know supposedly about Judas. It's the story of Jesus told from the perspective of Judas. And if you listen to some of the breathless kind of anticipation and propaganda out there about it, we're being told that it's going to revise the way the church understands Jesus and Judas. Well, not hardly. Today we're going to be looking at this very closely, and in just a few moments we will welcome a special guest, Professor Daryl Bach of Dallas Theological Seminary, who's a world scholar on this very document and on this question. We'll turn to that in just a few moments, and I wanted to give you some warning so that you can call some friends, alert some people to what we're going to be talking about today, because this is going to be big, big news. It's going to be a matter of very widespread cultural conversation in America. Because there is so much interest in these Gnostic Gospels, and we're going to be talking about why we call them that and how we should understand them as Christians, but that in just a few moments. First, to review some issues in the news, I just had to pick up today on something at Slate.com. It's an article by Stephen Waldman, who's editor-in-chief of BeliefNet, and he's offering suggestions about how religious liberals can recapture their political agenda, but he gives a typology. Now, a typology is an effort to try to identify within a species, the different kind of variants. And let me just tell you some of these variants are. According to Stephen Waldman, the variants of religious liberals include, number one, the Bible-thumping liberals. He identifies these with Jim Wallis and Tony Campolo. He says that both sharply disagree with democratic orthodoxy in favor of removing religion from the public square. And the issue on which they're problematic for the religious left is abortion. He says this: in some cases, the Bible-thumping liberals are pro-life. In other cases, they supported legalized abortion but want to reduce the number of abortions. Then secondly, he talks about the pious peaceniks. This is a group of white liberal Protestants, Catholics, Reformed Jews, and he says an occasional Buddhist. And what he says here is that this is the anti-war movement in a new guise. They were, he says here, very suspicious of the Bible thumpers and of Bill Clinton's New Democrat philosophy. And goes on and says their basic issue is war. And, of course, with the war in Iraq, they've got something to talk about. The third category, he says, are the ethnic churchgoers. And he says these may be the most problematic for the religious left because they can be counted on to be liberal on social and many political questions. But when it comes to issues like gay marriage and abortion, they're not going along. In particular, Stephen Waldman recognizes that there was an incredible influx of Hispanic Catholic votes for President George W. Bush, precisely over issues of marriage and abortion and all the rest. He also says the other problem for the religious left with African Americans is that 64% of African Americans oppose gay marriage. So there's the problem, he says, for the left. The conflicted Catholics, that's his fourth category. They're conflicted because they're like liberal Protestants and other liberals and Jews on poverty, war, and the environment. But they're less likely than secular liberals to hold pro-lifers in contempt. And many of them are actually, he suggests, at least uncomfortable with abortion. And then the last group he calls the religious feminists, the newest faction aiming to win for women the right to control their own bodies. Feminism runs up against the patriarchy of many religious institutions, but some feminists still want to find a way to use spirituality. That's the word he uses here. Now, why would we talk about this today? It's because when you talk about the religious right, as is so often a part of the conversation in America, we need to remember that there is a religious left. It's not as potent. It's not as powerful. But there are persons on the left who claim a Christian commitment and are trying to push the Christian church in these directions. Now, I think this is of interest because as a conservative, I want to recognize that not all political positions are easily identified on the left or the right as liberal or conservative. There are a lot of economic and justice issues that don't fall neatly into a liberal-conservative dichotomy. The question of immigration being debated right now is creating some unusual coalitions. Where does justice call for us to reshape our immigration policy? Where does national security call for us to enforce our immigration policy? How do we redefine citizenship in the 21st century? What does this mean? What is our obligation? What is our obligation to each other as citizens? These are huge questions, and they're not easily defined as left and right, liberal and conservative. But when it comes to the issues like gay marriage and abortion, you bet this is a very clear divide between liberals and conservatives, progressives and traditionalists, the left and the right, the blue and the red, however you want to define it here. Now, Stephen Waldman also says this, and he points to abortion as the key issue, but I want you to hear what he says. When speaking of Catholic voters, for instance, he says, and I quote, this is an exact quote, "To frame abortion for this group, Democrats at least need to pretend that they want to reduce the number of abortions. And even as they fight to keep abortion legal, the Dems shouldn't mock pro-life advocates as sexually repressed theocrats or describe abortion as a merely surgical procedure." Now, that's where I have to jump and say, you know, when he talks about pretending to want to reduce the number of abortions, he's actually calling for them to be disingenuous, dishonest. And I think now that he's told us what he's calling for, we need to watch to see if that's the kind of advice that they take. You can find the article for yourself by going to albertmoeller.com. Follow the link. It'll take you to Stephen Waldman's article at slate.com. And you can make your own decision about his typology and his advice to the religious left. A lot of attention these days, of course, to boys. The problem is that males are falling behind. Young males are being outperformed by young females, whether they are boys, adolescent boys, or young men. And this is a big problem. Leonard Sachs, who is author of the forthcoming book Boys Adrift, argues in the Washington Post that boys and young men are falling behind in terms of achievement and motivation. Now, I'm quoting to you from his article here. It's very interesting. He says this cuts across all demographics, the rich and the poor, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, urban, suburban, and rural. One-third of young men ages 22 to 34 still living at home with their parents. That's a 100% increase in two decades. Not the same for young women. Now, he goes on here. He says there could be some reasons for this. Let me quote directly from this. He says, "So far, we've just been asking one another the question, what's happening to boys? We've batted around lots of ideas. Maybe the problem has to do with the way the school curriculum has changed. Maybe it has to do with environmental toxins that affect boys differently than girls. Not as crazy an idea as it sounds," he says. "Maybe it has to do with changes in the workforce, with fewer blue-collar jobs and more emphasis on the service industry. Maybe it's some combination of all of the above or other factors that we haven't yet identified." Well, I have to come back and say, listen, when you talk about environmental toxins, we need to focus on the fact that this isn't a chemical problem, it's a cultural problem. This isn't a problem with some chemical out there that's affecting boys differently than girls. It's the fact that the masculine virtues that would lead young men to lead and succeed have been derided and marginalized in this culture. And we can't expect that young men are going to grow up to be men. We can't expect that boys will aspire to be men if we simultaneously undermine the very substance of what it means for young men to grow up, to lead, to succeed. We have to recognize that there are masculine virtues that we should find in males. And so long as our school system and the larger culture and the media and all the rest are tilted against that, we shouldn't expect anything other than the kind of confusion among young men that we find. And also the fact that there are many of them that are simply falling behind. We know the political season is kicking into full gear, and one sign of this is the fact that Russ Feingold, that is the Democratic senator from Wisconsin, who is widely anticipated to be a 2008 presidential candidate, has now come out in favor of gay marriage. And he's done so in a pretty stunning and unconditional way. In an interview with the Washington Post, he has said that any attempt to pass a constitutional amendment to prevent same-sex marriage is, quote, a mean-spirited attempt to single out gay men and lesbians for discrimination. He said he would vote against it, but then went further, announcing that he favors legalizing same-sex marriages. This is what he had to say, quote, "Obviously, it's a very difficult issue and evokes lots of emotions. I think it's ultimately something that people throughout the country will accept, but it's not an easy issue." Well, he says further steps would be appropriate. And he wants to defeat a proposed Wisconsin amendment and the federal constitutional amendment. And yet he's the first of the major Democratic candidates or potential undeclared candidates at this point to come out and announce that he intends to support same-sex marriage. That's going to tilt the conversation on the Democratic side. It's going to tilt our national conversation and gives us just a little hint of how things are lining up for the 2008 presidential race. Folks, we're often closer to history than we think. Nina Countess Schenk von Stauffenberg died on Sunday at age 92. Her husband, the Baron von Stauffenberg, was one of the conspirators against Adolf Hitler, who attempted to assassinate the Führer in the midst of World War II. He had lost seven fingers and an eye in battle, and coming from Bavarian nobility, had supported Hitler's rise, but he began to see through who Hitler really was and the threat that he presented. After he was discovered in his conspiracy and along with others was executed, the Countess von Stauffenberg was sent to Ravensbrück concentration camp. She was eventually liberated, and she lived until this past Sunday. Folks, history is often closer than we imagine. That's World War II. What about Judas and Jesus? We'll be talking about what the National Geographic disclosed today. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Today, the National Geographic Society unveiled what they claim to be a 1,700-year-old document, 13 pages of papyrus found in a Middle Eastern desert, written in Coptic, and now called the Gospel of Judas. There's been a lot of word about this. The manuscript has not been unknown for about 50 or 60 years. At least some folks have been talking about it. There have been rumors about it. And now it is out, and a critical translation is now available in book form, and it's already in the bookstores. As a matter of fact, it's called The Gospel of Judas. It's edited by Rudolf Kosser, Marvin Meyer, and Gregor Verst. And let me just tell you that the big question about this is going to be, and the media is going to be presenting this in an avalanche, what does this really represent? Are we going to have to revise our understanding of Judas and of Jesus and the gospel because of this text? It raises all kinds of questions. The background of this includes the upcoming release of the movie The Da Vinci Code, all kinds of interest in what we now call the Gnostic Gospels. And this is the time for intelligent Christians to take a deep breath and just get ready. Right now, the latest Google News search shows 133 news stories over the last 2 hours on just one thread. Get ready. You're going to be hearing about it on the news. It's going to be in the newspapers and discussed. And to help us discuss this is our guest today, Dr. Daryl Bach, who is a research professor of New Testament studies and professor of spiritual development and culture at Dallas Theological Seminary, and a well-known New Testament scholar and one of world renown. And Dr. Bach, we welcome you to the Albert Mueller Program.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Professor, you know what the question is going to be. Does this force us to revise our understanding of Judas and Jesus?
No, I don't think so. It is an interesting text for 2nd and 3rd century Christianity, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the 1st century Christianity, and therefore it doesn't require any revision at all. It's an attempt to rehabilitate Judas by taking a more sympathetic take on him and his actions in handing Jesus over to the Jewish leadership, but it really doesn't relate to the historical Judas or the historical Jesus at all. And what's interesting is James Robinson, who is one of the editors responsible for the Nag Hammadi text, these Gnostic Christian texts, says the same thing. So this is not just something that a conservative is saying.
No, but I think it's important we look at this, and I appreciate the way you introduced the issue there, because the question that I think the man and woman on the street and the average Christian is going to hear is, look, why don't you revise what you're saying about Judas? The way you tell the story of the betrayal of Jesus and his passion and crucifixion, this is going to force a change. I think this gets back to the big question of why we trust the New Testament, and in particular the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and not all these other writings that are called Gospels. Professor Bach, you know, in the background to this is also the Da Vinci Code and all the interest in the Gnostic Gospels. We've talked about that on this program. These, of course, are these Gospels that the early church rejected. And yet the constant theme of these Gnostic Gospels is that there is a secret that the reader is let in on by reading this and by joining this group. And Professor Bach, when I read the Gospel of Judas, the text just released today, I have to tell you what struck me more than anything was even more than its message about Judas is how thoroughly Gnostic this really is.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons it doesn't tell us anything about the historical Jesus or the historical Judas, is because it is a reflection of Gnostic theology. Not only that, it's a reflection of a particular wing of Gnosticism. It's what's called Cainite Gnosticism. And the Cainite Gnostics had made a habit of trying to rehabilitate questionable questionable figures. They tried to rehabilitate Cain. They tried to rehabilitate Korah. They tried to rehabilitate the Sodomites. And so this is part of their standard operating procedure to take a negative figure and try and put a positive twist on them, because they're really trying to get Gnosticism is really influenced by Greek philosophy, and what it's trying to argue is that it is the spiritual idea and not the physical world which is of value. And so your flesh, the material creation, is corrupt from the beginning. That's different than the Old Testament. And as a result, anything that separates the spiritual from the physical is good. And that's really what these texts are trying to do.
Well, I want to quote from the text just to make that point. And this gets back to a Platonic dualism between the physical and the spiritual worlds. And just as Professor Buck has said, the Gnostics really privileged the spiritual and suggested that the physical world is what we need to escape. According to the Gospel of Judas, this text that was released today in published form and the press conference with the National Geographic includes this statement in which Jesus is supposedly speaking to Judas. Here are the words: "But you will exceed all of them, for you will sacrifice the man that clothes me." Now, that's a clear reference to the crucifixion and to the death of Jesus' body, suggesting that Jesus is more or less trapped within this body from which he needs to escape. And Judas then, according to this telling of the tale, becomes the agent of liberating Jesus from his body. Dr. Buck, what's the problem with that?
Well, of course, the church believed that it was the real Jesus who suffered, and that when he suffered, it was all of him that suffered, and when he was raised, it was all of them that was raised and transformed. There are variations of this in the Gnostic Gospels to the extent that the person who's crucified on the cross is a substitute for Jesus, and Jesus is in heaven laughing at what's going on because he's tricked people into thinking they've crucified him when he hasn't. Now, that teaching is a variation of Gnosticism. It's not this text and what this text is teaching, but this text is along the road in that direction.
Well, it certainly is along the road, and it also picks up some other things that surprised me a little bit, Professor Bach. For instance, the astrology that really permeates this document. Here's Jesus speaking to Judas. "Judas, your star has led you astray. No person of mortal birth is worthy to enter the house you have seen. Neither the sun nor the moon will rule there, nor the day, but the holy will abide there always in the eternal realm with the holy angels. Look, I have explained to you the mysteries of the kingdom, and I have taught you the error of the stars, and I send it on the 12 eons." It went on and said, Jesus here again speaking to Judas. Judas had asked, "Master, could it be that my seed is under the control of the rulers?" He says, "No." He says, "You will become the 13th, and you'll be cursed by other generations, and you will come to rule over them. In the last days, they will curse your ascent to the holy generation." You know, Professor Bach, when I hear that, that even goes beyond some of the Gnostic texts that I've read and appears to be almost like Zoroastrianism.
Well, it's this ascent language, which is very much a part of these Gnostic texts. And what's interesting here is that this text is almost for certain a text that Irenaeus described in A.D. 180. He actually mentions these 13 eons in discussing this passage. And so, the interesting part of this is that this is a legitimate second century text. Irenaeus wrote in A.D. 180, so we know this gospel existed before then. But the claim that it's connected to Judas, of course, no one accepts. And in contrast to the biblical gospels, which all have apostolic roots, this text clearly has Gnostic roots, and Gnosticism is something that emerged in the second century.
We're going to ask Professor Bach to stay with us here, but as we go into the break, I want to ask the professor one question here. What significance should we ascribe to the fact that this text is found in Coptic?
Well, just the Coptic language is the language of many of these Gnostic texts. It's the same language as we found in the text at Nag Hammadi, and it suggests a circulation in an area of Egypt.
Well, the Metropolitan Bishoy, who is the head of the Egyptian Coptic Church, that is the Coptic Orthodox Church, has dismissed the document as, quote, non-Christian babbling resulting from a group of people trying to create a false amalgam between the Greek mythology and Far Eastern religions with Christianity. He went on to say, "These texts are neither reliable nor accurate Christian texts, as they are historically and logically alien to the main Christian teaching and philosophy of the early and present Christians," end quote. Fairly good and concise analysis, I would say, there from Metropolitan Bishoy, the Coptic Orthodox Church. What do you think, and how should we think about this? Maybe you have some questions. You can ask Professor Daryl Bach of Dallas Theological Seminary, and you can get your question on the record. Call us 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast, This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back. We're talking about a 13-page papyrus document written in the Coptic language, now called the Gospel of Judas, translated into English, and the book is already, and I find this very significant, it's already discounted as a bestseller at some of the trade bookstores. One of my research assistants went out, found it on display, 30% off jacket on it already. This has got an agenda behind it, folks. In this day in which you can count just about anything on the internet, the growth of registered news stories at websites like Google tells you something. Just a few minutes ago, 130 stories, now 141 major newspapers. We're going to be facing this conversation for a number of days, and it's part of the larger context to build up to the Da Vinci Code movie and all the rest. This is where we need, again, to just pause and think clearly about how we as Christians ought to intelligently, carefully, and responsibly address the questions raised by a supposed discovery such as this. I say a supposed discovery because this document has been known to exist for some time, but it's only now being available to scholars and raising all kinds of questions. With us today is Professor Daryl Bach of Dallas Theological Seminary, where he serves as research professor of New Testament studies. We want to invite you to join the conversation by calling 877-893-8255. You may have read about this, heard about it, or perhaps you're just ready to kind of talk about it. The number, 877-893-TALK. Professor Bach, you know, when I look at this document and I see the very clear distinction between this, which is called the Gospel of Judas, and the four canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it just reminds me of how important it was for the early church to identify what was and was not trustworthy. You know, how do we judge the way the New Testament church did that and the later church in the second and third centuries as they thought about which documents do we trust and which documents do we see as heretical?
Well, I think the short answer to that is that there are two key features to the Gospels that are important. One is their apostolic roots, and the other is the breadth of their circulation, both across time and geography. Beyond that, there also is a distinct difference in theology between these works. I have a work in preparation called The Missing Gospels, Unearthing the Truth About Alternative Christianities, that compares these extra-biblical missing gospels to the canonical gospels and the teaching of the second century up to Irenaeus on four areas: God and the creation, the person of Jesus, the nature of salvation, and the work of Jesus, to show how different this material is, this second and third century material is, from the Orthodox tradition of the first two centuries. Because there are a lot of people going around now claiming that what we had in the beginning, in the first century, was just a bunch of Christian alternatives. There was no orthodoxy. And so it's important that Christians understand their early church history, not just of the first century, but also of the second and third century, and how we got our Bible, in order to understand what's being claimed and how that's not correct.
In the local bookstores, you can find books by Elaine Pagels, Karen King, and Bart Ehrman, and others that really make these points. I think it's good to have that argument refuted just as clearly as Professor Bach did just there. I want to go to our caller from Tampa, Florida. Dee is listening on WTBN. Dee, it's your turn.
Hi. I was calling because I'm curious about how this ties into another gospel that I've recently heard about, but I don't hear much about, which is the Gospel of Barnabas. Is that an alternative kind of newfound gospel, or how does that relate?
Professor Bach, why don't you just go ahead and take this and tell us about the Gospel of Barnabas and where it fits in this picture.
What we have going on here is we've got two types of texts circulating in the second century. We have texts that are a reflection of Orthodox Christian beliefs, and then we have texts that are a reflection of this Gnostic strand. The Gospel of Barnabas, or the Epistle of Barnabas, is sometimes called, is pseudo-Barnabas. It doesn't really go back to the biblical Barnabas, but it does express a more Orthodox theology. In contrast to these texts, that's also a second century text. In contrast to these Gnostic texts, which are expressing a different view of God as creator. The key thing about this is that in these Gnostic texts, the creation is bad from the beginning, and God, the top God, if you will, because there are many little gods in Gnosticism, isn't directly responsible for the creation. That's against Judaism and Christianity. And so the reaction to these texts would have not only been because their teaching about Christ was a problem, their teaching about God the Father as creator was a problem as well.
Very good clarification. And Professor Bach here has given us the two criteria that really identified the canonical gospels, the authoritative gospels: apostolicity, that is, they're traceable to an apostle in the apostolic teaching, and catholicity, that is, the universality of their reception in the church. That's very important. You know, when you talk about these false gospels, let's remember that there are people alive today who like these gospels because they like that teaching better than Orthodox classical Christianity. When we come back, we'll talk about why. The number 877-893-8255, and I'm Albert Moeller. Well, the news stories are adding up. We should expect that. The press conference was this morning by the National Geographic Society, and we're told that the May issue of National Geographic magazine is going to have this ancient document on its cover and a major article on the Gospel of Judas. We have as our guest today Professor Daryl Bach of Dallas Theological Seminary, and we've been talking about how we as Christians should think about this. Now, our neighbors are going to be fascinated and interested with this. A lot of people are going to be picking up the book. There are a lot of people that have an historical interest. There are scholars that have a scholarly interest. But when we went into the break, I was making the point there are those who have a spiritual interest in this as well. Because like those that are kind of fascinated with the Da Vinci Code and some other things, there are those who would prefer a reformation or reformulation of Christianity more in line with where the Gnostics are. There are a lot of, New Age devotees. And others, especially there's a feminist strain right now that sees in these stories what some have called the reclamation of the divine feminine and all the rest. I just did a press interview on that a few minutes ago, just talked to USA Today about the Gospel of Judas. So get ready for a very, very interesting conversation. Professor Bach, we've got a caller from Holland, Michigan. Let's go to Michael. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi. My name is Michael, and the question I have is, there's a lot of references to the early church and the Catholicity of the Synoptic Gospels. If I was looking for a church today that most looked like the early church, so I could learn more about these kinds of things in my local community, what kind of church would I be going to? In other words, as I drive down the street, there's Baptist churches and Episcopalian churches and Catholic churches, and you mentioned Coptic, but I don't think I'm going to find a Coptic church in Holland, Michigan.
Well, you might actually be surprised. There are almost surely some Coptic Christians there. But, Michael, let me just tell you that you ask one of the big questions that that all Christians of a responsible thinking nature have to grapple with, and that is which churches claim to be most closely aligned with the Scriptures is true. I mean, you will not find a branch of Christendom that says we're at odds with the New Testament and proud of it. They all claim rival claims to representing in the most pristine and even primitive form, that is, going back with a succession of teaching, if not a succession of leadership, going back to the earliest Christians, even the apostles. And so, Michael, that is the big question. And I think, you know, what we really have to encourage as Christians is that each of us would read the New Testament and look at the teachings of the various churches and find that church which we believe most closely is aligned with those teachings. Professor Bach, what would you add to that?
Well, I think you won't drive down the street and find, you know, First Gnostic Church of Holland, Michigan, or something like that. What you will find in some churches is a belief that all these gospels are perhaps of equal value in teaching us about spirituality. You'll see a diminution or a lowering of the exceptional nature of the canon. We aren't claiming that these Gnostic Gospels of the second and third century have Catholicity. In fact, we're saying they don't. But what some people are saying is that all these Gospels speak for different, equally valid expressions of Christianity, and that's historically wrong. That's historically a false reading. What we had was an apostolic Christianity that talked about the uniqueness of Jesus, the uniqueness of his work, the greatness of God and his creation. And then these Gospels that came along in the second century said, you know, Christianity has too much of an edge to it. We're going to make it more like the spirit of our times, and we're going to inject some Greek philosophy into it and make it more palatable so more people might welcome what we're saying. That's what the Gnostic Gospels of the second century are, and we have some churches that are trying to do the same today and trying to eliminate the differences that exist in religious belief today.
Yeah, and that's certainly true, although I just want to make clear, as I know Professor Bach would agree, there is no denomination that is officially seeking to do that, at least in the major historic denominations we're talking about. But there was, and I won't even mention the church, one of the mainstream Protestant churches here in our community, actually replaced their Bible study with the study of Elaine Pagel's book on the Gnostic Gospels. I mean, that's kind of an indication of what's going here. And this New Age mentality, and kind of the postmodern worldview, leads to this. So, you know, we can incorporate this. We can use this. And the other thing I want to do is defend the Coptic Church here, just to make clear. This is a document written in the Coptic language. That's an Egyptian language. But the official Coptic Church, the Coptic Orthodox Church, that's the reason why I quoted the Metropolitan Statement, is not accepting this as their contribution to Christian theology. They are making very clear.
What you're getting in these churches that we're talking about, they won't make it a doctrinal statement or whatever, but when you watch to see how they talk about the Bible and whether it's any different from these other texts, if they're equating them all and treating them all the same, that is the four Gospels plus all these other Gospels, or maybe just one or two, maybe a Gospel of Thomas by itself or something like that, then you know that they are moving in this, or have moved in this direction of embracing this kind of undefined Christianity in which there were many alternatives as opposed to holding to an Orthodox Christianity.
That is such an important point, and I would just want to affirm that over and over again. That's exactly right. When you hear people talking about these documents as authentic alternatives to the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that's a big danger sign. Let's go to Charlie, calling from Effingham, Illinois, on XM Satellite 170. Go ahead, Charlie.
Dr. Muller, Dr. Bach, thank you for having me on your show. How many Gnostic Gospels are there?
Well,
I know there's three.
Yeah, well, actually, there are several, but I can't give you a number. My guess is there may be some out there that aren't even known or at least in hand yet. But, Professor Bach, how would you answer that question? How many are there?
Well, part of the problem here is it isn't just Gospels that discuss the life and ministry of Jesus. So if we're asking how many use the title Gospel and how many extra-biblical Gospels are out there, you might be dealing with a dozen and a half. If you include anything and everything that discusses the name, that discusses the ministry of Jesus or his resurrection appearances, that list goes up to about 32, plus six fragments that we have that we don't have enough of to give a name to, and they include all kinds of things like the Apocalypse of Peter, the Apocryphon of John. My favorite name out of all these is Hypostasis of the Archons. I just think that's a great name.
Yeah, it sounds like a bestseller.
The Reality of the Rulers.
Yeah, it sounds like somebody ought to make that into a movie, and probably will at some point. It's been great to have Professor Daryl Bach as our guest today on the Albert Mueller Program. I'll be back in just a moment with some final thoughts. I want to suggest to you a work which is available in your local bookstore or over the Internet that will be helpful to you. It's entitled Jesus Under Fire, Modern Scholarship Reinvents the Historical Jesus. It's edited by Michael Wilkins and J.P. Moreland, and Professor Bach has an outstanding chapter in this book, really defending the historicity and the authority of the four Gospels. Professor Bach, thank you so much for joining us.
My absolute pleasure. Anytime.
Folks, we'll be back in just a moment. Thank you for your calls, and we'll just have some final thoughts about how we ought to think about this while all our neighbors are getting ready to talk about it. I'll be right back. Folks, we are in for an interesting season. We have the debut, the release of the Da Vinci Code coming out. I just participated in a major interview today with the television film crew talking about that development. And then along comes this morning's release of the news about the Gospel of Judas and the release of the book, the National Geographic Society. We're talking about here a major cultural institution that is putting its heft and reputation behind it. The book, The Gospel of Judas, edited by Rudolf Kasser, Marvin Meyer, and Gregor Verst, is already in the bookstores. I have a copy of it right here in my hand, and I've read it, and I looked at it. I haven't read every word of the gospel yet, but I've certainly read those passages that most clearly are at stake here relating to the betrayal of Jesus. And I've read the preview of the text that was released by the Society. And I have to say, the first thing that struck me is just how pervasively Gnostic it is. And you heard that word over and over again. Maybe you have a new word for your vocabulary and family conversation today. It's G-N-O-S-T-I-C, and Gnostic or Gnosticism. You could go on from there. And it means gnosis. That's the Greek word there about knowledge. And that's the big deal, isn't it? We do not in Christianity have a secret faith. We have a faith that we clearly proclaim. That's the distinction here. We do not follow a Gnosticism that is some kind of secret society, nor do we have a hidden secret. We tell persons the open secret about Jesus Christ, the Messiah. We do not believe that creation was a corruption and that we need to overcome the material world. Instead, we talk about what God did in creating the world for his glory and as the theater for the drama of redemption, and how God's plan is for a new heaven and a new earth, not to escape the material, but to transform and redeem even the material world. These various gospels that or sacred writings, as they're called, or historical writings tied to Christianity, there are people that will jump on them immediately and say, look, on the basis of this, we need to revise Christianity. Well, let's face the facts. The early church looked at these documents and said, that fails the test. It's neither apostolic in its rootage, nor is it universal in its reception. It clearly presents a different faith than the faith of the Christian church. Now, you go into a bookstore today, you'll find all kinds of religious books. Well, the ancient world was pretty much the same way. Anyone with a stylus and some ink and a piece of papyrus could write his own gospel. But that didn't mean that it became authoritative for the church. No, very much to the contrary. The church identified Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the 27 books of the New Testament as the authoritative deposit of authentic Christianity. I'll stake my life on it. I have staked my life on it. That's the faith of the church, and that's what unites us as Christians in understanding that where we find Christianity defined is in the New Testament, the Holy Bible, the inerrant, infallible, and inspired Word of God. Let's be ready to engage our neighbors in intelligent conversation about the Gospel of Judas and about all the issues that cross our attention. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about Hugh Hefner's 80th birthday and what that means for America. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.